It's the Burt Cohen Show. The dream involves peace, it involves justice, it involves values, it involves what America is about, and we are a player on the world stage, no doubt about that, and there's a lot that's been going on. One of our closest allies, of course, is the State of Israel, and you talk about controversy, what's been going on in the summer of 2014 with the Gaza Strip. Boy, there's a lot of controversy about that. And the role that the U.S. is playing is a big one. And it brings up a lot of questions, what Israel, what the Palestinians, what Hamas is doing, what the role of Judaism really is, how the State of Israel is reflecting or not reflecting Judaism, what it might be doing to Judaism, which is a lot bigger than just Zionism. Well, I'm very pleased to have with us on the Burt Cohen Show today, Rabbi Michael Lerner. Rabbi Lerner, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Rabbi Lerner is editor of Tikkun Magazine, chair of the Interfaith and Secular Humanist Welcoming Network of Spiritual Progressives, and rabbi of Beit Tikkun Synagogue Without Walls in San Francisco and Berkeley, California. And we are talking about Judaism and Gaza. He wrote an article that said, Israel has broken my heart. I'm a rabbi in mourning for Judaism being murdered by Israel. Well, there's a lot to it there. And I personally, obviously, Burt Cohen, it's a Jewish last name. I am Jewish, proud to be Jewish. I grew up believing in, of course, Jewish values, Jewish ethics, which are thousands of years old, and believing in the State of Israel and its importance. What was the uniqueness about a Jewish state that earned, Rabbi Lerner, earned and kept your support all these years? Why has it been important as a rabbi, as a Jew?
Well, there are two levels of that. On the one hand, as a Jew, I was delighted that there was a place that had been established as a kind of affirmative action, compensatory justice place for the Jewish people. After all, while I was alive, I was born in 1943. In the years between 1940 and 45, one out of every three Jews alive on the planet was murdered, and this was the culmination. This wasn't some wild exception. This was the culmination of 2,000 years of persecution and oppression, primarily in Christian Europe, but also second-class status. Kind of apartheid conditions for Jews in many Arab lands. So for Jews to have after the Second World War, to have a place which would be safe for us as Jews to live, always seemed an extremely important thing to me. And although I was grateful to the United States of America and to the generosity of the American people, that it did not turn against Jews and allow anti-Semitism to predominate in this society, I always felt a little uneasy knowing that the societies that had opened their doors to Jews in the past had later on turned against Jews. Of course, it's somewhat different in the United States because in Europe, we were the primary other that the ruling classes could direct anger against. When people were angry at things in their life, they could be told, well, it's the fault of the Jews.
Yeah.
Whereas in the United States, unfortunately for them, the African Americans were the primary other. So Jews were able to get a degree of security in this country because of the racism directed not against us, but against African Americans. I was never sure that racism might not at some point jump up again. And so I was very glad that there was a place in the world where Jews would be safe. But the second reason is that because we were exiled from our land, thrown out of our land some 2,000 years ago by Roman Western imperialism, we were we have never been able to create a reality that would reflect Jewish values. And I had had great hopes that Israel would be the place where the Jewish people could experiment in reinvigorating Jewish values and making them real in the world. So for both of those reasons, I was an enthusiastic supporter of the State of Israel.
Well, you've said a lot there that we at times have been the other, and obviously after the Holocaust needed some world recognition of that, and this certainly happened. Now, Rabbi Lerner, what specifically, the title of the article is Israel Has Broken My Heart, I'm a Rabbi in Mourning for Judaism Being Murdered by Israel. What specifically has broken your heart?
Well, I mean, the most recent fact is the wildly excessive destruction of Gaza by the Israeli army. Whatever the provocations, there was no excuse for killing over 2,000 Gazans and wounding over 7,000 Gazans. And the brutality of that and the way that Israel essentially wiped out much of the economic base of Gaza, destroyed over 200 factories in a little tiny little area where, in any event, people had been on the verge of just bare subsistence. It was one of the lowest level, one of the most economically deprived areas in the world. All of that led me to feel deep sadness and about what Israel was doing, many levels of that, but one, just the humanitarian level, it just seemed so outrageous and so unnecessarily hurtful.
But Israel has, of course, been the target of Hamas rockets again and again and again. And the argument is that, well, Israel needs to defend itself from these rockets. And if the allegation is that the Hamas used innocent civilians, including children, as shields, and that they were hiding the launching places of the rockets in, say, schools, even UN schools. And so the Israeli Defense Forces launched major attacks against these targets. What doesn't that legitimize some of the incidental killings?
Well, these were not incidental killings. These were systematic killings. And no, it doesn't. If you know that there are a huge number of civilians, and, I mean, first of all, there's not a shred of evidence that Israel has presented to support the claim that any of these military attacks on apartment buildings, on UN schools, et cetera, were actually based on solid evidence that that these were places where there were military, where there were guns or whatever.
Rockets.
Being used. There's just not a shred of evidence for that. And the last time Israel made this same claim in the, its 2008, 2009 invasion of Gaza, and the UN committee, Human Rights Committee, that it was just a bogus claim. There was no basis for that claim. So I don't believe. I mean, I don't believe it for a second. Secondly, let's imagine that it's true. Oh, I mean, let's switch it around a little bit. The Israeli army is located in almost every home in Israel because the Israeli army, everybody is recruited into the Israeli army. Now, I'm glad that Hamas's rockets were not able to fall on the cities that were that they were aimed at. I'm glad that Israel had an iron dome to protect it.
Sure.
But if they had fallen there and the Hamas had said, you know, these homes that we are targeting have in them Israeli army people. Well, the truth is every home does have Israeli army people. Okay? So, in other words, the argument here falls to shreds because you can't just target civilians and say, oh, yes, well, there's a reason to believe that there is some military equipment there. Otherwise, the whole notion of protecting human rights falls into meaninglessness. So we wouldn't accept that from, we wouldn't say, oh, Hamas's attacks on those cities were not terrorist attacks because there was reasonable grounds to believe that the that there were military people in all the homes that were being attacked. Similarly, Israel's defense is vapid, empty, and has no legitimacy. If they had if they're saying here we have one or two places where we think we have concrete evidence, but even apart from all of that, we're dealing with a situation in which you have to step back from the particulars and look at the larger picture. And the larger picture is Israel has been occupying the West Bank and Gaza since 1967. Okay, that's 47 years.
Yes.
Right? It's the longest occupation of any place on the planet by so they can't. That occupation has been oppressive to the people there. They're rebelling against it, and so of course, in every whenever there's a people's rebellion, you can always say, "Well, we have to kill everybody there, because we have no choice." It's like the United States in Vietnam,
right.
One general said, "Well, we had to destroy the village in order to save it from communism."
Right. I remember that. If you just tuned into the Bert Cohen Show, our guest today is Rabbi Michael Lerner, editor of Tikkun magazine. And just briefly, the word Tikkun, to heal the world, is that basically what it means?
Yeah. Tikkun means healing, repair, and transformation. Tikkun Olam means healing, repair, and transformation of the world. And it's a beautiful concept in Judaism. It's actually a central concept in Judaism, because Judaism came into the world as a revolutionary religion with an idea that really challenged all existing forms of oppression. It was Judaism came out as as the religion of the slaves who had become free. And what those slaves understood and asserted is that there is something in the universe. In English, we call it God. In Hebrew, it's different. It's called Yud-Heh, Vav-Heh in Hebrew, those four letters,
mm-hmm.
which aren't even supposed to be pronounced.
Right.
Those four letters, that something about the universe that makes possible the transformation from that which is to that which ought to be. And if you read the Bible and instead of every place where you see the English word God, you instead substitute the force that makes for the possibility of transformation from that which is to that which ought to be, you'd get a better sense of what was the revolutionary message of Judaism. So that message says that the world can be healed and transformed, that we're not stuck, But every ruling class, from the ancient world right up into the American Empire and the 1% of the population that runs this society, have tried to convince all the rest of the people that the way things are is the only way things can be, and that we have to be realistic and accept what is, because no fundamental change is really possible. So Judaism has always generated a great deal of anger from the ruling elites of every country, and they have done their best to try to convince their own populations that the Jews are bad people, and to stay away from that. And in response to that, Jews have done their best to try to run away from the revolutionary message of our people and try to cuddle up the ruling classes and say, hey, it's just a religion. Don't take it that seriously. We'll just do it on Friday night and Saturday in synagogue and on our holidays. But we don't really take it that seriously, so you don't have to worry about us. We're going to be loyal to the existing order. But ruling classes have never fully bought that, because the content of the Torah, the content of this message, is a revolutionary message. And so even if Jews say they're not taking it seriously, that our story is a revolutionary story. Our story is we were slaves and now we're free. And the Sabbath, the weekly Sabbath celebrations, every Friday night and Saturday, the periodic Jewish holidays, Passover, for example, Hanukkah, they're all about people who are oppressed becoming unoppressed. And that message is a revolutionary message. So the ruling class can say, ruling classes of every society can say, you tell us that you're loyal, but your message is one that's going to convince people in this society that the message we're trying to teach them, namely that nothing can be changed, is baloney. Because your very existence as a people is proof that something could be changed, because you were slaves and now you're free. And you've made a whole religion based on that.
Interesting. You remind me, of course, of what Martin Luther King said at one point. I don't remember the exact words, but the arc of history, bends toward justice. Sometimes it takes a long time. So it's a very similar message. And, of course, we saw what happened to Martin Luther King and many other people that are seeking to make change. Rabbi Lerner, you write that, quote, for Judaism, belief in God, continuing what we're talking about, was precisely a belief that love and justice could and should prevail, and that our task is to embody that message in our communities and promote that message to the world. Now, many have said that's really unrealistic. What's your response to that? Is it not unrealistic?
Yeah, it is unrealistic. That's exactly why I say screw realism.
Well,
don't, you know what? Being realistic has brought us a world in which today we have between 5,000 and 8,000 children under the age of 5 who will die of malnutrition or diseases related to malnutrition. It has brought us a world in which hundreds of millions of people over the course of the past century have been killed in crazy and brutal wars.
Yeah.
It has brought us a world in which today global capitalism is accelerating its assault on the environment in such a way that that there is very good chance that the life support system of our planet will be destroyed within the next 50 to 100 years.
Mm.
That's being realistic, okay?
Yeah.
That's what it is to be realistic. Being realistic is accepting the current contours of power and economic inequalities and the maldistribution of wealth and the goods of the planet, and saying that can't be changed. Okay, that brings us a suicidal path towards global destruction. So in the face of that, I say the primary injunction of Judaism, but really of any rational human path, is don't be realistic. Don't be realistic. Do not accept the current contours of power and economic wealth as fixed. Because if you do, although you may get a portion of that for yourself, you may do well in the short run, you are actually contributing to the destruction of the planet and the destruction of the future of the human race.
And Rabbi Lerner, you also said, going along with that, the worship of power is precisely what Judaism came into being to challenge. How does it seems like that's really current, that, you know, the worship of power is precisely what Judaism came into being to challenge. And I can see why, of course, the power structure would, you know, the power elite would not like that. How does that relate to the war on Gaza that has been happening?
Well, okay. You see, what we find is that in Israel has the majority of Israelis have abandoned Judaism. And have as their goal to be a nation like all other nations. And this was actually explicitly stated in the visions of the early Zionists. They wanted to create a nation like all other nations. You know, in the early days of the State of Israel, after it was created, you'd see articles by people celebrating the fact that we had Jewish thieves and Jewish prostitutes in Israel. Why? Because that meant that we were normal. We weren't this abnormal people that was living by some standards that were different from the rest of the world. Mm. Okay, they've won their battle. Israel is normal. Yes, it's very normal. In fact, it's so normal that it's acting according to some of the worst principles of nation states around the world. Israel, by the way, in my view, is not at all the worst of nation states. On the contrary, Israel's crimes are relatively light compared to the crimes of, for example, the United States, Russia, China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Syria. In no way do I want to single out and say that Israel is the worst country in the world. But as a Jew, I'm deeply disappointed. But as some more than disappointed, I am heartbroken for another reason. And that is that in the past 20 years or so, Israel has the leadership of Israel has increasingly claimed that Israel is the Jewish state, not a state with a lot of Jews in it, but the Jewish state. And the Jewish state, having said that, gives the impression that Judaism is being manifested in Israel.
Wow.
And that's what particularly breaks my heart, is mm-hmm. to see people then turning against Judaism because they think it is adequately represented or that this is what Judaism is in practice. Whereas, in fact, the founders of the State of Israel said, hey, we don't want to be a Jewish state. We want to be a state like all other nations. But if you want to be a Jewish state, then you have to live according to Jewish values. And that's precisely what Israel's not doing.
My goodness, yes. And, you know, it seems to me, I've studied history a little bit, that, you know, Judaism, the people Israel, which I consider myself to be a part of, is a wonderful tradition of ethics and values thousands of years old. Zionism came out of, correct me if I'm wrong, the late 19th century. All over Europe, there was this push for nationalism, you know, different little nation states combined together. And there was this new push for nationalism. And it sounds like that kind of goes along with what you're saying, you know, just another state.
See, Zionism is the national liberation struggle of the Jewish people. Remember that at the end of the 19th century, Jews were still an oppressed minority all around the world.
Oh, yes.
And the Zionist idea didn't start in the 19th century. It started when Western Roman imperialism pushed us out of our lands 2,000 years ago. And ever since then, the Jews have sought to go back to that land. However, in the 19th century, after Jews had been let out of the ghettos and Christians no longer had official laws against Jews in Europe. But then suddenly, the ruling classes at the time decided to use the previously long history of anti-Semitism as a way to stir people up against the Jews and blame the Jews for all the problems of capitalism. At that point, Zionism, which had been there in the 1900 years before as an aspiration of the Jewish people to return to our homeland, took on a nationalist form. The nationalist form meant that it wasn't just that we wanted a homeland, it's that we wanted a nation with our own army, with our own power base. Now, again, there's nothing intrinsically evil about that, except that the place that we picked to go back to, our ancient homeland, already had a people there.
Right.
They were living there. And Zionism, early Zionism, took the traditional aspirations of the Jewish people to return to our homeland, combined it with European nationalist sentiment, and then totally ignored the reality of a people that already existed in the land of Israel, namely the Palestinians. It said, in fact, that some of its 19th century publicity said, this is a movement for a land without a people, for
right.
people without a land.
I remember that.
But actually, there was a people there.
Yeah.
By the end of the 19th century, there were already 700,000 Palestinians living there. So this was Zionism quickly combined with the kind of European chauvinism and inability to recognize native peoples. And so that was a big problem, because to get there and the Palestinians were not real happy to have us there. Now that was a problem on the part of the Palestinians, because there was no reason why the Palestinians should not have welcomed Jews to come to that society. It wasn't as if there wasn't enough land there. There was enough land there. So there was a racism towards Jews. And that happened in part because the ruling classes in Palestine in the late 19th and early 20th century were these absentee landlords who were very much afraid that if Jews came there, they would bring capitalist values. All the worse when it turned out that the Jews who came there in the late 19th and early 20th century were mostly socialists.
Yes.
They were socialist societies. The Palestinian leadership at that point was terribly upset that their own people would be infected by capitalist or even socialist ideas and overthrow their rule, which actually did, in fact, happen by the middle of the 20th century. So what they did was they told their own people, hey, these Jews are coming to expropriate your land. And why did the people believe them? Because the Jews didn't speak Arabic, and they were not interested particularly in building relations with Arabs. I can explain that in a second. But and the Arabs who lived there were illiterate. There was a tiny percentage of the population that could read. So they got their information primarily from the mosques and from the radio stations. And the mosques and radio stations were controlled by these absentee landlords who were trying to stir Arabs up against the returning Jews, the Jews who were trying to make return to their ancient homeland. Now, why didn't the Jews figure out a way to reach out to those Palestinians? Well, they felt the hostility of Palestinians, and instead of thinking to themselves, yeah, but maybe we could counter this by explaining to people that we're not here to throw them out of their own land. We're only here to try to build a little homeland for us, and it won't force them to leave or whatever. Instead, the Jews responded to this situation of their hostility by hostility, which I'm trying to say, was not legitimate. okay, no more mm-hmm. legitimate than the hostility of Irish people in Boston to blacks coming to Boston from the South, and Irish people saying, no, you can't come here. We built this land for ourselves. Palestinian resistance to Jewish immigration was illegitimate in the same way. It was racist. It was inappropriate. There was plenty of land to share, etc. But the Jews responded not by thinking, oh, let's reach out to them and try to build an alliance, but rather by saying, no, what's different? The Goyim, the non-Jews, they always hate us. So uh-huh. we have to figure out what's going on here. We know that's why we want a homeland, because the non-Jews always hate us. They always treat us terribly. So you had two sides, each of which, given their history and given their understanding of the world, saw each other as antagonists from the start rather than sought to build some kind of connection and mutual understanding.
Oh, it's so fascinating to learn history, and it's so incredibly important to learn history. I mean, this stuff that you were talking about, Rabbi Lerner, it's virtually unknown. Of course, as time went on, you know, they did appropriate a lot of Palestinian land, hundreds of thousands of olive trees, destroying homes, water resources, so that they ended up...
That's after the creation of the State of Israel you're talking about.
Right, right.
Yeah.
But...
terrible.
Yeah.
All of that was... is part of the process of the occupation, why you can't look at Gaza and simply say, "Oh, they're using terrorist tactics." The Palestinian people would not be using terrorism if they had an army, an air force, and a navy like the Israel does. Whenever there's a rebellion of an occupied people against the occupiers say, hey, these are terrorists. Yeah, because all they have, that's what they have. They have rocks. They have, you know, they have some weapons. Hmm. But they don't have the weapons, you know, none of the weapons. I'm going to say, thank God, because I love Israelis, and, you know, they're my brothers and sisters. I don't want them hurt. But at the same time, I don't want them to be able to say, oh, we're on such a higher moral plane, we don't use these same tactics. When actually what they're doing is they're killing, they've had about 60 soldiers killed, about 3 civilians killed, mm-hmm. in a war where the other side has had 2,000 people killed. The disproportion here is unbelievable. And then Israel acts as though it's the victim. Well, no.
No, it has victimized a great number of people. I want to ask about Hamas, but I just want to follow up on what you were saying. Would it be appropriate for Israel to face charges of war crimes at the International Court in The Hague? And, you know, what about, you know, the silence that's pervasive around the world about, you know, some of the things that Israel has done? I mean, is it complicity in this?
Well, you know, certainly there's complicity, although the worst case is the United States, which has been arming Israel right in the middle of this war. We are just at the moment at Tikkun magazine, which, by the way, people can get to our website, TIKKUN.org, and needless to say, the kind of things that I'm saying does not endear us to a good section of an important section of the organized Jewish community.
For sure.
We get a lot of hate mail, mm-hmm. Also systematic attempts to make sure that nobody gives us any support. So we really need support from anybody who thinks that what we're saying makes sense. They should go to our website. You can donate to us. You can join. You can subscribe to the magazine. You can join our interfaith and atheist welcoming secular humanist welcoming network of spiritual progressives. You can do that either at www.tikkun.org or at spiritualprogressives.org, spiritualprogressives.org. So, you know, we are faced with a lot of opposition because we are willing to say things that almost nobody else is saying. So today we are right now in the process of vetting an article that that we may soon publish that on Israeli war crimes in this current situation, and the article that we're looking at is one that maintains that the United States is equally culpable because the United States has armed the Israelis, and it did it even after knowing how many the disproportion of civilians
right.
that was being killed by this
assault on Gaza, yeah,
by the so
and
there is considerable. Argument that the that not just Israel but the United States is culpable for war crimes.
Well, yeah, it's
and I'm not a lawyer, so I'm looking at this article that we're right now considering publishing, and it seems like a pretty tight argument.
And if they're not. So be it, you know, if they could be charged and then found innocent, you know, why not? I mean, there's this international pressure on Jews from a lot of Jews. You know, I'm sure, Rabbi Lerner, you've heard more than you want to remember the term self-hating Jews. You know, it's an instant allegation of anti-Semitism against any critics, and you write that the American Jewish community and Jews around the world have taken a turn that is disastrous by turning the Israeli nation state into the Jewish state and making Israel into an idol to be worshipped rather than a political entity. And, you know, it seems to me that I'm getting this sense there's this tremendous pressure in families. There's disagreements. I can tell you in mine, for example, many American Jews seem to be more loyal to this state of Israel than to traditional Jewish values. That makes me feel very sad, and I think you've articulated a lot of those traditional values.
Yes. Well, I mean, let me just point out that the Torah has repeatedly says one version or another of the following. When you come into your land, do not oppress the stranger, the other.
Uh-huh.
Remember that you were strangers in the land of Egypt. So now, why does the Torah bring this more than any other commandment in Torah? Because it understands that there's a huge human tendency to pass on to others the pain that was passed on to us. You know, to do unto others what was done to us.
No.
The whole claim of there being a God of transformation, a force that makes possible the transformation from that which is to that which ought to be, mm. is a claim that says that the repetition compulsion, what our Jewish boy Freud called the repetition compulsion, the tendency to pass on from generation to generation what was done to you, to others, that tendency, according to Judaism, can be broken, that the chain of pain can be broken. And this is a central argument that I make in detail in my book, Jewish Renewal, A Path to Healing and Transformation. Jewish Renewal, Path to Healing and Transformation, in which I show that the Torah is all about trying to show you that you don't have to pass on the pain. But what's going on for Jewish people is, having been victimized for so long, we are passing on the pain to other people. It's like, it's a terrible tragedy for other people who are the victims, but it's also a deep violation of Judaism, and there couldn't be a more powerful testimony to the why the state of Israel is abandoning Judaism, and but it's abandoning it and claiming it's Jewish, claiming that it is the state that manifests Judaism. And that's what particularly upsets me as a rabbi, because I'm continually trying to attract people into our community who tell me, I can't be Jewish anymore because Israel's actions are so disgusting, and I see what Judaism is in practice. And what I'm trying to say is, no, it is not Judaism in practice. They are not. They are the violation of Judaism in practice. It's not the embodiment of Jewish values. It's the destruction of Jewish values.
Yeah, could you explain? I think that'll surprise a lot of people that Judaism is not really such a big deal in Israel, that you would think, you know, people are religious there and trying to be, you know, live by the Torah, by Jewish law. Describe that a little bit more. Are they just...
Well, 80% of the people in Israel are not religious. And so there's no real serious attempt to live by Jewish moral values there. And most don't, they don't observe the Sabbath or the other Jewish traditions. So it's only that they claim, you know, that they speak Hebrew, but they don't act according to Jewish values.
We are talking on the Bert Cohen Show with Rabbi Michael Lerner, editor of Tikkun, T-I-K-K-U-N magazine, and chair of the Network of Spiritual Progressives, about how a lot of the actions of Israel are breaking his heart and breaking up, and hurting Judaism, really. What about, you know, we've seen the rise of anti-Semitism in places like France. How the world is getting this impression, Jews equal the government, the right-wing, militaristic government of Israel. How can Israeli actions be in part blamed for the rise of anti-Semitism, people confusing Judaism with what Israel is doing?
Well, let me say that, yes, it can be. That doesn't mean that it's in any way legitimate.
Right.
Always illegitimate, as every form of racism is illegitimate.
Yes.
By that I mean that what anti-Semitism or all other forms of racism do is that they take the behavior of some part of a group, and then that they have reason to denounce, or they have reason to dislike, and then they generalize it to all members of the group. Okay, so most Jews are not. That are not living in Israel, and they're not, and most Israelis are not killing children in Gaza. Okay, this is, it's like if somebody came and said, "We hate Americans. All Americans are screwed up people. Why? Well, they killed 3 million people in the war in Vietnam. That's that's a genocide that is one of the great atrocities of the contemporary period."
Yes.
So we'd say, wait a second, we didn't do that. I mean, our government did that. Well, yeah, but you're responsible for your government. Yeah, but I was protesting against it. I didn't agree with that. Okay, but do you see what I'm saying? It's like,
well,
you can't blame all people. That is a racism. That is an unacceptable way of thinking. But nevertheless, it actually is the way that a lot of people do think.
Yes.
In the world. And so, yes, there's going to be a lot of anger that is generated by Israeli action that is generalized towards Jews.
Yes.
Particularly now when the Jewish people around the world in our Jewish institutions are saying, right on, Israel, you're doing the right thing. Okay? In that situation, it becomes even harder to make the argument, hey, you shouldn't blame the Jews. When you've got so many Jews around the world, at least in the federations and in the American Jewish Congress and the American Jewish Committee and the B'nai B'rith and the Anti-Defamation League and all of the and most of the rabbinical associations and the they're all you know, all the reform movement, the conservative movement, the Orthodox movement, they're all lining up in support of Israeli behavior. Well, that is generating a lot of anger that I believe is going to manifest in anti-Semitism in years to come. And when it does, even though, as I say, it's totally illegitimate, when it does manifest in that way, the Jewish people are going to be in danger again. Ironically, Israel is creating the circumstances that will justify the need for Israel. Because if Jews are hated all over the world, they mean we may all need to go back to Israel as the one place where we're not hated because we're Jews.
So I never like self-fulfilling prophecies. It's always frustrating. You know, and the power of Washington, it's really interesting how involved Washington, the government of the United States, is in this. There's part of it, of course, is the right-wing Christians. They have this belief in the end of the world. And how is this affecting U.S. policy in Israel?
Well, it's certainly affecting it because the combination of the Jewish establishment here with its great amount of resources and power and ability to shape the discussion in the media, and on the other hand, the electoral clout of the Christian Zionists that has brought in solid support for Israel from Republicans and from the most racist elements in our society, all this combines to make it political suicide for many many elected officials who might otherwise be standing up and critiquing human rights violations. But unfortunately, the United States is the primary enabler of Israeli human rights violations today. And Israel knows that if anybody raises these issues of human rights violations in the United Nations, that the Obama administration or any other likely administration is going to veto any resolution to bring these an investigation of these human rights violations to the International Court of Justice. So Israel is thus given a clear path to continue human rights violations without ever having to worry about being called to account for them.
And what a, you know, looking at Washington, it seems virtually unanimous in the halls of Congress that Israel may not be criticized. What about the power of AIPAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, in the halls of Congress over budgetary decisions? Are they as...
AIPAC is a manifestation of this solid organized Jewish community support for Israeli policies. And it's a it plays a very destructive role. But, you know, even J Street,
yes,
which was set up as a pro-peace organization,
right,
rarely is willing to confront the Israeli, congressional or the administration's blind support for Israel and its willingness to cover up and deny any prevent any investigation of human rights violations by Israel. So in that way, it's almost across the board here. You see Jewish organizations just solidly opposing any serious attempt to call Israel's policies into question, or at least opposing any attempt to stop the United States funding Israel's assault on Gaza, or requiring the United States to allow a serious investigation by an international court of whether Israel has in fact been violating human rights. I mean, I'm willing to consider the possibility that it's not true and that they'll be found innocent.
Right.
The United States won't allow there to be such a trial.
No. And you can't even, I mean, liberals, conservatives, everybody is just marching in lockstep with AIPAC seeming to control, absolutely control the power in Congress. Now,
well, that's why it's important. But you see, people who don't agree with this, there are a lot of people who are liberals or progressives in this country who don't really agree with what Israel is doing.
Right.
But they don't put their money behind an alternative. Here's Tikkun magazine, and here's our network of spiritual progressives, two voices that are critiquing Israel out of love. My criticism of Israel is not because I want to see Israel destroyed. I want to see Israel preserved. And the only way it's going to be preserved is if it ends the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. It allows the Palestinians to have a economically and politically viable state and makes peace with the Palestinian people and has an open-hearted reconciliation with the Palestinian people. I want that for Israel because I want Israel to survive. I think that these people who are giving blind support to Israel are actually Israel's worst enemies because they are supporting policies that in the long run will destroy Israel rather than preserve Israel. So, but the people who are critical of what Israel is doing or who agree with what we're saying, they don't put their money behind Tikkun or the network of spiritual progressives. At best, some of them put some money into J Street, but J Street, as I said, refuses to challenge the administration when the administration rejects any attempt to consider Israeli human rights violations. It refuses to challenge the administration when the administration comes in with huge amounts of money to support and to support Israel's attack on the Palestinian people and to continue, essentially de facto, enabling Israel to continue the occupation. Or when the United States resupplies in the middle of the Gaza war, Israel with these advanced weapons that will that are then used against the people of Gaza. So why don't they do that? Why don't people who agree with who feel that there's a moral issue here, who feel that the United States policy is wrong, who feel that Israel is doing the wrong thing, why don't they put money behind a voice like Tikkun's or the network of spiritual progressives?
Or Jewish Voice for Peace, that's another one.
Hey, we've got so many different things that we have to support, etc.
Yeah.
Well, the right-wing Jews and Christian Zionists, this is their number one issue. And so they put their money, they put their political energy into supporting those institutions. And America still has enough democracy in it that their democratic input plus their money makes a big impact, whereas the liberal and progressive forces rarely put their energy and emphasis on supporting those of us who are critiquing Israeli policy.
Well, there certainly is a lot of fear about speaking up. Is it possible? What could be done? We only have just a couple minutes left for a real and lasting peace. Specifically, there's the wall, the blockade of Gaza. There are separate roads for Jews and non-Jews. There's the idea of the 67 borders. Is there possible to be peace and justice?
Well, there's certainly possible. There's nothing but the consciousness that needs to be changed. And that's why consciousness change is really the central issue, both in regard to Israel and in regard to the United States. And not only on this issue, but on the most fundamental issue, which is the most fundamental issue is this. How do you achieve homeland security?
Mm-hmm.
There are two worldviews that are in contention. One view says the only way to achieve homeland security is by domination and power over the other.
Right.
And then that's the dominant worldview in the United States and in Israel. But there's another worldview that comes from Judaism and Christianity and Islam and Buddhism and Hinduism and all of the spiritual traditions of the world. And this different tradition says that the way to achieve homeland security is through acts of generosity and caring towards the other. And that it is possible to build security through love, not through power, domination, and control and violence. So that's the basic message of Tikkun and the network of spiritual progressives and why it's so important for people to join the network of spiritual progressives, spiritualprogressives.org, or to support Tikkun magazine, tikkun.org, because that message is the critical issue. If you don't believe in that, if you don't believe that it's possible to have a world based on caring, then of course you're going to use violence and power over, and that eventually leads to more and more violence, more and more violence. Well, we've tried the strategy of violence for the past 5,000 years at least. It doesn't work. It doesn't generate a world of safety. It generates unsafety and endless wars.
Thank you so much.
Try the Tikkun strategy. Try the Jewish strategy. Try the Christian, the Muslim, the Islamic, the Hindu, the Buddhist, the spiritual strategy. All of that spiritual strategy is love, caring, kindness, generosity, open-heartedness. That's what we at Tikkun are about.
We can make it happen. Thank you so much. Very, very informative, very interesting. It should stir things up a little bit. Rabbi Michael Lerner, again, Tikkun Magazine, or Network of Spiritual Progressives, just spiritualprogressives.org or tikkun.org, I believe. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And maybe we'll have peace on earth. Email me, Bert@BertCohen.com. Love to hear from you. Thanks.
The day is blue, there's nothing to do but watch the sad review of life going by. All the broken people in a world of hurt, and all the hungry people crying in the dirt, all the living people dying to be free from all the suffering in between. I turn my eyes away from it all, but still a wall of pain resides in me. Turn on the news, the killing continues.